One of the easiest ways to identify a true follower of Jesus Christ is how compassionately that person treats other people. The Savior's message is clear. His true disciples build, lift, encourage, persuade, and inspire. No matter how difficult the situation, true disciples of Jesus Christ are peacemakers.
Hello, this is Gabe Fry from the University of Utah Institute of Religion. During this podcast, we will be discussing anti-religious rhetoric and anti-Mormon rhetoric, as well as doubts and unanswered questions. And today I'm joined by Brother Halverson, who is a teacher here at the Institute. He hails from California, did a mission in Puerto Rico, got a PhD, and he's very willing to share his insights with us today. So thanks for being with me, Brother Halverson.
Any chance to hang out with you, Gabe, is a good thing, so.
Thanks. Well, let's broach this topic gently, I guess, at first. Anti-religious rhetoric. First, tell us, what's kind of your background in anti-religious rhetoric?
Sure. Well, I guess part of it's personal and a lot of it's academic. I grew up in Southern California, like you said, and had friends of all kinds of different faiths. I've heard it said that if you mix devotion with diversity, you have a potential problem on your hands. If there is devotion but no diversity, it's fine because, hey, everybody feels strongly about something, but they all agree on it, so you're good. On the other hand, if there's incredible diversity but not much devotion, again, you're safe because it's like, hey, none of us agree with each other, but we don't care about what we disagree on, so we're fine. Mm-hmm. But when you mix the two and it's we care deeply about things we don't agree on, okay, there's some potential for problems. But looking back at my childhood, I had an incredibly diverse circle of friends that were very, very devout in their various religions. I went to BYU to go to the LDS school, while my friends went to Notre Dame to go to their Catholic school. Mm-hmm. I had a Hindu friend, had Jewish friends. A good friend of mine was a born-again Christian who, it's funny, I now teach religion for my church. He teaches religion for his church. We're both religion professors. And usually on Mondays, he would come to me and say, after English class, and he'd say, okay, this is what we learned about you guys yesterday. And I was like, what? I had no idea that other churches talked about us in negative ways. But he would come with his sheet of anti-Mormonism every Monday. And I was thankful that he had the courage and openness to actually show it to me and say, how much of this is true? Because he had a lot of LDS friends, but he's hearing this stuff and what's accurate and what isn't. So it gave me a chance to defend myself. But it also exposed me to some of the things that, oh, wow, okay, that's not true, or that was taken out of context, or wow, that's really creative. I've never heard that one before. But that was my first kind of personal exposure to anti-Mormonism. I didn't think anything would come of it. But during my graduate school years, I'd been already been teaching seminary and institute for 10, 15 years by then, but started a graduate degree at a divinity school in the Bible Belt. And so you're going to get bombarded with other people's perspectives on your faith when you're mm-hmm. in the Bible Belt, first of all. And then at divinity school, where everybody wants to talk shop and talk religion and so on. But I had done some research on the people's perspective on the Book of Mormon when it first came out. And I was blown away at how dismissive every newspaper account was. That they just made the Book of Mormon into a laughingstock without even really cracking the book open. And it really struck me that, wow, they're not engaging with the content of Scripture. Mm. They're not arguing rationally over its possibility or not. They're mm-hmm. just hearing some story about a gold Bible and some angel in the woods, and they just ridicule it. And that really was what tipped me off to, wow, there's an approach here, because I kept seeing it I read every newspaper article from the 1830s through the end of Joseph Smith's life that talked about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Wow. And they were just almost uniformly dismissive without taking seriously the content of the message. And so that's really what started to tip me off of, seems to be some kind of an approach to how do you dismiss faith? And the deeper I went with anti-Mormonism, it then began to expand out to study anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism. There's anti-Methodism. I've studied anti-Shakerism. I mean, you name it. If you're a person of faith, you tend to have a bullseye on your chest. Mm. And the deeper I got into it, the more common threads I started to see. And it drew me into this, trying to make sense of rhetoric. That used to be one of the key things every educated person had to study was rhetoric. But that was 200 years ago, and nobody seems to study it anymore. And the deeper I got into it, I realized, whoa, this is the gold mine as far as the theoretical lens to view anti-religion, because it's religion. So it's faith, which means I can't prove to you that it's true. That makes it hard for missionaries, right? Or apologists. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you can't prove to me that it's false. And so that makes it really hard for polemicists, the ones that are attacking religion. And so if religion is non-provable and non-disprovable, what are you left with? And in some ways, well, you're left with words. You're left with, I'm just going to try to say something in such a way that I hope I can convince you that I'm right or that you're wrong or whatever it might be. And that's rhetoric. The way Aristotle defined it was making use of the available means of persuasion. Mm. And so how do I, you know, as a missionary, how do I persuade people to give the Book of Mormon a chance and pray about it? If I'm trying to attack your faith, as we so often see or experience, what are they saying and how are they saying it in hopes that I will lose hold of the iron rod and wander away from the tree of life? So it's been amazing the last decade or so studying that. I see a lot of value in trying to help people navigate their own crises of faith, just to see, okay, this is what they said and this is how they're saying it and this is what they're trying to get you to think or to feel. And it's been an interesting journey.
So interesting. At the risk of sounding redundant, mm-hmm. could you just restate for everyone listening what rhetoric is?
I mean, in a single word, it's persuasion. But more expansively, it's anything I can do to try to convince you of my argument. Rhetoric's gotten a bad reputation over the years. It's sometimes been called the harlot of the arts, where it's this idea of, hey, anybody can hire rhetoric to do its dirty work. And so you see it in politics all the time. Mm-hmm. You see it in advertising. You can't avoid rhetoric because we're all trying to make an argument in some ways.
Right.
And so it's simply a matter of how do I say things in such a way that I'm convincing or persuasive? Mm. Well, think about this. The first Antichrist you meet in the Book of Mormon is Sherem, right? Uh-huh. And each of the three main Antichrists, Sherem, Nehor, and Korihor, have a slightly different approach. When you meet Nehor, it's all about this. I mean, he's most known for his physical strength. And so there's this kind of visible charisma of, wow, that guy looks like Gabe. You know, I mean, this guy's ripped, right? Here's somebody that commands attention, right?
Right.
But when you meet Sherem, our first one, his was a rhetorical charisma.
Interesting.
The way he's described in Jacob 7 is that he had a perfect knowledge of the language of the people.
That's right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean some foreign tongue. It's, this is how they communicate. These are the words, the buzzwords, the kind of language that will mean something. And so when it talks about him using flattering words, so mm-hmm. often that's a word that's used with the language of those that are opposing faith. And flattering words, well, there's rhetoric for you. We think of flattery as, oh, you look so good today. But if flattery is simply, I'm going to say something you want to hear, then yeah, that's rhetoric too. Paul described it as people having itching ears and heaping up teachers after their own lusts so they can kind of scratch that itch. And I think the most powerful rhetoricians on the negative side know just where to scratch or just what to say so that you really start second guessing yourself and thinking, why do I believe that? Or have I been wrong all this time? And mm-hmm. and I found it helpful when you know what they're doing. I mean, to me, it's like watching game film on the adversary. You know, it's like reading the Screwtape Letters from C.S. Lewis they did do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I've had students over the years ask me, like, man, you study anti-Mormonism all the time? How do you keep your faith in spite of it?
Right.
I said, well, part of it is simply I'm more focused on how they're saying it even more than what they're saying. Obviously, I have to see what they're saying. I'm like, okay, yeah, I understand your argument or this is a concern that you're raising. But so often it's almost more than message, it's meta-message. What's the message behind the message? How are they approaching it? Mm-hmm. And once you see the smoke and mirrors, once you see the rhetorical sleight of hand, it's a little easier to say, oh, you actually aren't saying anything there. Or you're trying to get me to feel a certain way and make an emotional decision. Anyway, there's so many examples, but the deeper I get into rhetoric, the more grateful I am that that kind of information's out there to learn how to approach these things.
Yeah, you've hinted now several times, I think, at ways you've identified rhetoric. And I think this is important for everyone. You've said that already, like to understand rhetoric, how to identify it. You mentioned as a kid, you kind of picked up on, this is how I'm being persuaded. These are kind of the methods. You mentioned the Screwtape Letters. I think that's an amazing book and really does expose a lot of the rhetoric that we see as far as anti-religious rhetoric goes. But for you, maybe what's kind of a first step? I think a lot of times these persuasive arguments, they come at us on social media. They come in conversations with people, and we're a little maybe caught on our heels. Like, I don't know exactly how to respond. And when those emotions get caught up in and our feelings get caught up in such a response, it can be hard to like parse out, what was the message and what was the rhetoric, how it was said.
Yep. Well, it's all happening in real time, you know? And so exactly. It's like, what do I say? And
yeah.
You know, it's to me, one of the things that's interesting about it is to read something, to hear something, you watch a video, you hear a podcast, whatever, that is saying something negative about the faith. There is almost the need to separate yourself from the emotion of the moment and think hard, think through what is being said, how are they saying it, what's their goal, what's their bias, what angle are they approaching this information from. To me, it's been interesting. The more I've studied across the board, because honestly, anti-Mormonism, we're a small target compared to a long history of anti-Christianity, for example. And so the skepticism of the Enlightenment, for example, there's just so much out there. And the more that I've studied it, I kind of boil it down to these three S's that I find kind of across the board when somebody's attacking somebody else's faith. Well, the first S is sensational. They try to sensationalize it, make it shock and awe. I mean, that's how Hollywood sells their movie tickets, right? You know, sure. If I can get people in the door, because usually it's sex, violence, race, money kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And to think about people attacking the church, how do I sensationalize it to get the shock and awe factor that, A, it draws them in that they're curious, and B, it kind of tips them off of the intellectual or logical, rational approach and turns it into some kind of an emotional thing of, and here we are kind of freaking out over something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if it's sexuality, well, that's easy. Let's talk about plural marriage. If it's race, that's easy. Let's talk about race and the priesthood. If it's violence, that's easy. Let's talk about the Mountain Meadows massacre or trump up rumors about the Danites or do something like that. Yeah. Money, well, let's, you know, turn the church into a corporation instead. Mm-hmm. And where's the transparency? And what are they doing with my tithing?
The tithing.
Right? That's the first one. Let's get them up in arms and let's shift things from rational to emotion.
Right.
The second S is superficiality. Let's make it as superficial as possible. Mm-hmm. And just give a surface level kind of dusting of information. It doesn't even have to be false. If it's not deep enough, then even truth can be misleading because it's out of context. There's not the other side of the story. It's so many times when somebody has some question of like, I just saw this thing and did you see this infographic on Joseph Smith's wives? It's one of my favorite pieces of anti-Mormonism, actually, because
really?
It's so superficial and so sensationalized. Because there's a 3-volume set of information on plural marriage during the Joseph Smith period. And I just laugh and think, you really think you can reduce that to an infographic? Really? It's way more complicated than that and so much more nuanced. And so you got to dig deeper than an infographic or a meme. You know what I mean? And so there's...
Yeah.
The superficiality of it, you got to go deeper than that. And then the third S is selective. And it's so selective, it's like being in a debate and the moderator only holds the microphone to one candidate. You know, and so I'm only going to give you the information from the lawyers for the prosecution, for example. Well, now you know what the judge and jury is going to decide.
Right.
And not giving someone else a chance to offer counter evidence or to, you know, counter arguments or cross-examine the witnesses or things like that.
Right.
And so a lot of times when somebody will bring up, I read this thing, and there's some pretty famous examples out there that have been very effective in people leading people away from the church. I don't know if I need to name them and to give them even more publicity, but, but typically they're classic examples of sensationalized and superficial and selective approaches to our history or our doctrine, our faith. And there's just more to the story. And so, you know, calm down, first of all, you know, act in faith, realize it's okay. There's two sides to this story. Get deeper, go beyond the superficial and try to understand what else is out there. See it, back up and look at it through the big picture of the plan of salvation, historical context, the time period, so forth, and make sure that you know that there's other sources out there and there's other people you can ask and other historians that have weighed in on things. And there's more to the story than typically is given.
Yeah, that's so good. I want to take you back to the second S, superficiality. Uh-huh. And the thought that kind of came to my mind as you were talking about that was, it's interesting, you mentioned the infographic, which is clearly lacking the nuance and the depth of information that's available. Why do you think it still has so much power? Why does it have such an impact still when it's so, like you said, like shallow as far as information goes?
Well, I think part of it, the problem is we've gotten to a point where we lack the patience and the perseverance to be good students of history or good students of scripture or good students of life. There's times I'll have somebody come in, because I work with a lot of people in faith crisis, and they'll come in and sit down in my office and they'll start explaining their situation. Sometimes I'll say, do you like to read? And when they say no, I just like, bummer, because that closes you off from a lot of good help. And unfortunately, that might not just foreclose the solution, it might be part of the problem. Because we've kind of been retrained by culture. I've heard it referred to as digital Babylon. And being retrained by digital Babylon into, if it's more than 140 characters, I don't want to read it, you know. And if it can't be reduced to a picture or an emoji, it's like we're going back to hieroglyphics. It's like,
yes,
we had developed language for a reason. That's a good gift,
right?
But we just want it quick. We want it easy. We don't want to have to pay the price. And I'll say one other thing about rhetoric that's fascinating. There's a rhetorical term called an ideograph. And an ideograph is a word that's very vaguely defined that has such cultural cachet that it's untouchable.
Yes.
Some people have called them God words, and their opposites are devil words because they have that much power. But the interesting thing about those kinds of ideographs, because they're so vaguely defined, you really have to get into the semantics. Like, well, what do you mean by that?
Yes.
You know, it's, so I'll give you an example. In early America, common sense was one of the ultimate ideographs. And reason was another one because it's the Enlightenment and people want to be rational and think through things. And that's what made Thomas Paine such an incredible rhetorician, a writer. What did he name his book that basically changed the American Revolution? Common Sense. The amazing thing about it is ask centuries worth of their ancestors and they all would have assumed that, no, it's common sense to have a king. That's what we've always done. It's totally normal. And Paine's genius was to say, that makes no sense at all. It's totally absurd to have a king. Common sense would require that we're democratic and free. And the way he described it, he took hold. It's like he trademarked the term common sense and took control of the ideograph, saying, no, common sense is on my side. And unless you're an idiot and can't think for yourself, then you're going to agree with me. And thankfully, the American colonists did. But then fast forward 20 years, and he writes another book called The Age of Reason, which was totally anti-biblical and anti-scriptural and anti-religion. And people fell for that one too, because it's like, well, it's reasonable. It's reason, even though he didn't use a whole lot of reason in his attacks against the Bible. It was mostly ridicule. Anyway, fast forward and you go through the 19th century and the 20th century and ideographs are things like progress or things like freedom or things like American. Like that, you can't do that. That's un-American. It's like, well, what do you mean by that? Today, one of the most fascinating ideographs that's been used against the church in social circles is love. And it's so interesting because love, well, what do you mean by that? The Greeks had four words for love. We're kind of lumped together into one. What do you mean by love? But you can't say anything against love. And if one group can trademark love to say, no, and anything that you do against us, we can label unloving, then no wonder you feel horrible. You feel guilty because they said, I'm not loving. again, what kind of love are you defending? You hear it with pro-choice versus pro-life. Well, what do you mean by choice? And what do you mean by life? And they're vaguely undefined terms, but have so much power, you just can't say anything against them. And so it's been interesting to see that played out in a lot of things. And if I can make you feel like an idiot for believing in certain stories from, you know, the miraculous or the divine, then it's against reason. And I beat you with that one. If you're against certain communities or subgroups within society, then you're not loving. And so, yeah, interesting that we're still fighting those kinds of God words and devil words and so on. I guess what the bigger point I'm trying to make is whether it's a word that they throw out, whether it's an infographic, whether it's a meme, whether it's a joke or anything else, you really do have to force yourself to slow down and think and try to understand, are we defining the same words in the same ways? What is your goal here? I've had a lot of people ask me over the years, why do you call everything anti-Mormonism when it isn't always anti-Mormonism? I say, well, first of all, I don't label everything anti-Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And some people who wanted to attack the church, they would say, no, this is not anti-Mormonism. This is just straight up Mormonism. This is the history of your church, and there's no getting around some of these warts on the historical record. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, oh, yeah, good point, touche. However, anti doesn't just refer to content. It can also refer to approach and purpose. What's your design here? What's your aim? Because it can all be true, but if it's selective and superficial and sensational, you're still only giving people half the story, and that's unfair. So I guess my advice to people when they're in the throes of the sensational and they're starting to worry about things and question themselves, slow down, act in faith, be deliberate and intentional in your search for truth. Not only will it help you avoid the landmines that are out there, but the faith that you find on the other side will be firm, will be proven, will be intentional, you'll be mindful of it. It's not an accidental faith that the Lord is after. It's a very intentional one that He wants. And so in some ways, I'm grateful for the minefield that we're asked to navigate in the last days. I'm grateful that the internet, which has ushered in the information age and the misinformation age, it's teaching us to be better historians. It's teaching us to be better thinkers. Ideally, it's teaching us to be better disciples. And I think that's something the Lord is very invested in. So it's okay that we're up against these things. Opposition is a necessary part of growth. We just need to learn how to navigate it.
Wow. Just to kind of close this topic out, I want to ask you a question that we ask everyone that comes on this podcast. In addition to what we've talked about today, what are you doing, Brother Halverson, personally, in your life right now to build a firm foundation?
Let me take it back to Jacob and Sherem. The way that Jacob deals with this, because Sherem had specifically sought him out, knowing he was a person of faith and a person of influence. There's a dual target on your chest, right? Because this way, not only am I trying to rob you of your faith, but if I can take you down, I can take down other people with you. And so any of your listeners that are out there that feel that opposition and that tension, well, take it as a compliment. The adversary sees your potential influence and wants to bring down a lot of people by taking you down. Well, what Jacob says in response to Sherem's attempts to shake him, he says to him, I have the ministering of angels, and I've seen visions, and I hear the voice of God speaking unto me in very deed from time to time. Wherefore, I could not be shaken. And what I love about that is he's having frequent spiritual experiences from time to time, right? It's not just a one and done, like, oh yeah, I felt something once on my mission. Mm-hmm. The voice of God is very clear in my ears because I hear it often. And compared to his voice, you, Sherem, I don't care about your flattering words and your proficiency in persuasion. It rings hollow compared to the voice of God. And so I can't be shaken. It's the same thing that happened with Moses, you know. He's just had his epiphany with God, and here comes the adversary, and he's like, I don't even need sunglasses for you, Lucifer. I had to be transfigured for God, and you have no glory. And so for me, how do I keep a firm foundation? I keep listening to Heavenly Father. I keep studying His Word, and the closer I am to Him, the juxtaposition between light and truth is so clear. The problem comes when it's been so long since you've heard God's voice that you can't tell the difference when somebody else comes along with flattering words. Mm-hmm. So as I used to joke with students at Vanderbilt when I was there, what allowed me to navigate the rigors of graduate school, I never missed Institute. I mean, granted, I was the one teaching the classes, but but just having to keep my feet in gospel ground to study, to learn, that's what saved me then and saved me now and will continue to save me in the future. So how firm a foundation, the Lord's given us everything that we need. And if we'll simply make use of the means, as Captain Moroni said, then how can we fall?
My dear brothers and sisters, how we treat each other really matters. How we speak to and about others at home, at church, at work, and online really matters. Today I'm asking us to interact with others in a higher, holier way.
This podcast series has been produced by students at the Institute at the University of Utah.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend.
To direct others to this podcast, to listen to other episodes in this series, or to enroll in the Institute class associated with these podcasts, see our website at overcometheworld.podbeam.com.
This recording is not an official publication of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The views expressed are those of the participants and are neither the official doctrine nor the official teachings of the church.